Hello, I'm Lina Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. African Vaccination Week just concluded on April 30th. Experts say vaccination is a key intervention in the fight against the coronavirus. However, some countries are doing better than others in COVID-19 vaccine rollout. In Nigeria, health authorities are stepping up efforts to vaccinate more people against the coronavirus after a slow rollout, with support from Rotary and global development partners. On the program today, we continue to discuss vaccination and we look at the history of vaccines and Nigeria's experience in the deployment of vaccination against COVID-19. I spoke with Dr. Tunji Funcho, chair of Rotary's Nigeria National Polio Plus Committee and a 2020 Time Magazine 100 honoree. Take a listen.
Dr. Tunji Funcho, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Vaccines have been in the news for the past several months, given the COVID-19 pandemic. But before we even get to that, I wanted you to talk to us about the evolution of vaccines.
Vaccines have been with us, you know, literally for thousands of years. The Chinese, you know, are the most famous, you know, for having initiated the idea of inoculation in the real sense of the word, to use an inoculum from an infected person, you know, make some scarification on the skin and take some samples of the scab and inoculate someone else. So we're talking about way back during the Ming Dynasty in China. But then we also know that the Indian, you know, have, you know, drunk snake venom to immunize themselves against, you know, snake bites. And many stories, you know, coming from Africa as well, has shown that scarification and inoculation has gone back for centuries. So it's a long history, but the recorded medical tested one was, you know, the British doctor, Jenner, who used chickenpox inoculum to inoculate, you know, people, had a real scientific study to see whether it works, whether there were side effects. And that was the first real recorded, you know, scientific vaccination. And since then, in various parts of the world, we've had vaccines being produced for various diseases. The most, you know, famous one, of course, was the smallpox, you know, vaccine, which was the next vaccine that was produced incidentally. It's only also the first vaccine that was used to eradicate a disease, which was the smallpox that was used, you know, to get us to the point where we can say smallpox is an extinct disease now. So vaccines have had a long history. And also the fact that it's in the news so much, you know, because of people who are, you know, anti-vaccine campaigners, is not also new.
So exactly, I'm thinking all these years you just related, today is 2021. How did we go from people getting vaccinated against polio, against yellow fever, against all kinds of diseases in the past, and then today it's such a big controversy? How did we get here?
There have always been people at the fringe who have been against vaccine. The story is told about the Reverend Martha in Boston exactly 300 years ago, who had a bomb thrown into his home because he was campaigning for smallpox vaccination when there was a smallpox epidemic in Boston, in Massachusetts. This has been the case with vaccines generally, particularly when it comes to mass vaccination campaigns during epidemics. It's not new. For polio also, we faced a lot of opposition because of wrong information that was being peddled that the vaccine will cause infertility. And I remind them now that we are polio-free in Africa, that Africa's population, you know, has actually almost doubled in 30 years. So if the vaccine was causing infertility, we will have had a reduction in our population. It's an ongoing battle. And I think generally we just need to continue communicating in the language people will understand, so they appreciate that vaccines have been doing good in the world for centuries. If they were not, they would not have been the instruments for reducing infant, you know, and childhood mortality as drastically as done by 50% in most of Africa.
At the same time, when we think about part of the history where there have been cases where, for example, with the Tuskegee experiment here in the U.S., in the early years, 2000s, there was a clinical trial with regards to HIV/AIDS where some women were left infected. So you can see that people will focus on these experiences and really be reluctant. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's always good to put things in perspective. I mean, it was ethically immoral, the Tuskegee experiment. But the Tuskegee experiment was not about vaccines being given to people against their will or causing problems. It's about knowing that something can be advantageous and you withhold it. Because the Tuskegee experiment was allowing people to be infected with the syphilis and not giving them the appropriate treatment. Mm-hmm. Because it was a clinical trial, you know, where two groups with the disease, you know, you split them into two, you give one, you know, treatment, the others, you withhold treatment from them. These days, that trial will not have been allowed because it would be unethical, because you know the damage and the mortality that will be caused as a result of that. So in context, it's not actually about, you know, giving vaccines and the vaccines coming causing harm. It's actually about, you know, withholding treatment. But having said that, medical ethics, you know, has improved so dramatically that, you know, you cannot do a clinical trial now without peers of independent experts accepting and giving approval for it to take place, looking at all the ethical reasons. And we have known a lot of trials that have been terminated because it was discovered, you know, that there's a lot of disadvantage in the so-called placebo group, those who were not given treatment but thought, you know, they were being given treatment, were stopped, you know, because it will have been unethical to continue with those kind of clinical trials. So we've moved a long way from that. And I wish to reassure our listeners and the public in general that vaccines have proven their mettle over centuries. And there's no doubt about it. You know, the statistics will show that without some of these vaccines, we'll have had a lot of, you know, deaths. We'll have had a lot of, you know, people disabled as a result of some of these diseases, particularly the childhood diseases, that vaccines have been used now for decades to ensure that our children don't succumb from these diseases.
And speaking of childhood diseases, last year Nigeria was declared polio-free by the WHO. That was a big milestone. It took a lot to get to that point. Can you give us a sense of all that was involved to get there? Because at some point there was controversy, especially in the northern part of Nigeria, where some people didn't want to get vaccinated, getting their children vaccinated. You were on the forefront. Talk to us about that experience.
We learned a lot about what it takes to actually get vaccines and any form of health intervention to people, you know, that you've got to get the people on your side from the get-go. I think that is part of the new lessons we've learned, you know, from our polio eradication efforts that has now actually been bedeviling the COVID-19 vaccination effort. We needed to have done a lot more work in getting the appropriate communications to people so that we have their buy-in. You know, my famous saying that a friend, you know, got from a friend is that, you know, you cannot shave a man's head in his absence. And therefore, we needed to have done a little bit more in getting a buy-in, in being proactive in giving information to people about the safety and efficacy of vaccines right from the get-go, rather than, you know, being reactive when they start to resist being given the vaccines and debunking all the negative information that is out there about vaccines in general. I think, like I said, vaccines have proven their mettle. And we managed to, you know, overcome this through the efforts of, number one, you know, the political will from the government, and number two, the joint efforts, you know, of Rotary and our GPI partners, WHO, UNICEF, the CDC, the Gates Foundation, and in recent times, the Gavi Vaccine Alliance. And of course, you know, hundreds of thousands of field workers who actually have been the one to bear the brunt of some of the arduous work that needed to be done to get the vaccine finally to the mouths of children. Because no matter what else we do, the best of funding, the best of political will, if we do not finally get those two precious drops of the polio vaccine into the mouths of our children, we will not, you know, get to the stage where Nigeria and, by in consequence of that, Africa declare polio-free. So it's a lot of joint efforts, but more importantly, our field workers, you know, who have worked hazardous environments with risk to their life, As a matter of fact, in Nigeria, we lost 47 field workers, you know, who were targeted as a result of the fact that, you know, they were trying to immunize children.
The polio experience was with immunizing children for the most part. Now we have COVID-19 with immunizing adults for the most part. And you are seeing the resistance. It's not just an African problem or a Nigerian problem, but globally, there are so many myths and misinformation. What is being done, drawing from the experience of polio? How are you addressing COVID-19 immunization? And what are some of the differences, given that now we're talking about adults versus parents having to vaccinate their children?
Well, really, there is not much difference, because even with children, it's adults who we have to convince to bring their children to be immunized. So the strategy, you know, is similar. You know, one is to reach people using the voices they have trust and confidence in. And so traditional leadership have come in very, very useful, you know, to us in this campaign to get people to accept. The government, you know, with the support of partners, you know, have been holding town hall meetings across the states in the country. They've so far been quite successful. The traditional leadership at the highest hierarchy have been at these town hall meetings so that they hear from those they know very well and they can trust, who they know will not mislead them or put them in harm's way. Then, you know, we also use celebrities, you know, who also people know, who people also believe in. And Rotary in recent times, you know, we've put out, you know, huge billboards, starting with Lagos. We put, you know, out about 7 huge billboards. One of our celebrity ambassadors is Ali Baba, who is seen as the father of comedy in Nigeria. Unfortunately, he had COVID, he survived. So he's using that on this billboard, say, you have been, I've been there. I don't want you to get there, you know, get, you know, vaccinated. So we have these billboards, you know, around Lagos just to further get the message, you know, across, you know, to the adult population, because it is really to them that we need to appeal.
So how is the rollout coming along?
Well, the rollout has gone relatively smoothly. I wish we had more vaccines, because for a population of at least 200 million people, one will assume that you will have an eligible group, you know, and we're talking now of population above the age of 18, who will have at least 140 eligible people for immunization. So far, we've done only 1 million. So it's a long, long, long way to go.
How is Nigeria supplying its vaccines? Is it through COVAX, through the Africa Union, or buying its own vaccines? And what vaccines are you using?
Well, we're using the AstraZeneca from, you know, the COVAX vaccine group, which, as you know, is mostly supported by Gavi, Vaccine Alliance,
and
WHO, you know, and some other, you know, partners. So that is all we have. We've been promised 20 million. We have 4 million on ground. We've used just one. We have a pause now, and I think there will be a resumption next week of the second phase of the immunization, because the government has decided to not use all the vaccines before we get the next tranche, so that those who have their first dose also get their second dose. We're still a long, long, long way, you know, from getting to where we want to be as far as herd immunity is concerned. So right now I'm aware of the COVAX vaccines. I also, you know, hear that we are expecting some, you know, vaccines from the African, you know, Union, you know, vaccine, you know, group. Which vaccine it is, I'm not, you know, quite sure right at the moment. So what we have in the kitty is 3 million doses left out of the 4 million we had 2 months ago.
If you were to share some best practice, what would you say are some of the steps to ensure that there is an effective vaccination campaign, even when it comes to not only putting the jabs in people's arms, but also myth and misinformation, tackling those as well?
I talk about, in this instance, 4 thematic areas of activity. And I think the most important at the top of this area is advocacy. And that is one thing Rotary is very good at doing, because we're everywhere. There's virtually no part of this country that are no Rotarians. So Rotarians are on ground to advocate to where it matters most, the grassroots, the traditional leadership, the religious leadership. The traditional leadership is very robust in Nigeria, you know, right to the level, you know, the village level, and is the same in most parts of Africa. But of course, advocacy to the government at the central and state level is also crucial, you know, because there need to be the political will and the resources put out there to ensure that, you know, the amount of funding and also human resource that are required brought to bear so that the other things can follow. The next is creating public awareness. Following advocacy, the people that you are going to vaccinate must know that if you are carrying out a campaign, we are coming to your area at such and such a time, and you carry out this awareness to, again, the chain of people they have confidence in and they trust. So creating awareness directly using the different information media, the print media, the electronic media, and of course, you know, in these climes, social media to get to them. The next is to make sure the funds are available. Rotary has been quite pivotal to raising the almost $21 billion that have been spent so far on the effort through advocacy with governments and also raising funds within the organization. I must give, you know, a lot of credit to the Gates Foundation, who have been working with Rotary and in the last, you know, decade and a half. And in recent times, you know, match every dollar Rotary spends on polio eradication with $2. That is the funding aspect. And of course, you know, the final one, as you mentioned, is that all of those three efforts will be useless if we cannot actually get to the field and ensure that we get the vaccines to the mouth of the children. And that's a huge logistic undertaking. And we're talking about, you know, putting in the field literally 250,000 and beyond in just a small part of the country to actually go in the field and go house to house and give these vaccines to children as far as polio is concerned. So those are the four thematic areas. That is what has helped us in Nigeria to get to where we're going. And I think it is very important, you know, to follow those thematic areas to ensure that you don't miss any area that will contribute to the final success, you know, of such an undertaking.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tunji Funsho. It was great to have you share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Tunji Funsho, Chair of Rotary's Nigeria National Polio Plus Committee. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, your moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the latest top stories of the week, including a look at the challenges ahead for President Biden, who faces formidable battles to pass the rest of his legislative agenda on Capitol Hill. Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is James Barton, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. For a second year, Nigeria's Muslim population, the largest in West Africa, is celebrating the holy month of Ramadan under the cloud of COVID-19. Nigeria's mosques have resumed communal prayers and daily fast breaking, which were banned last year, raising concerns among health officials. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
Since Ramadan started April 13, Isa Idris joins hundreds of Muslims who observe special evening prayers at Abuja's Nasfat Mosque daily. And once the prayer has ended, they all proceed for iftar, a large meal to break the day's fasting. Idris says he struggled during Ramadan last year because of the pandemic.
As of last year, even for food in my house, sincerely speaking, God bear me witness, I found it difficult. It was my mom that helped me. But unfortunately, this year, I get food in my house, and I do my iftar here, and I also do my sahur here.
Sahur and iftar are meals to mark the beginning and end of a day's fasting. Hundreds of people at the mosque benefit from free meals through Ramadan. But feasting and communal prayers were halted last year as the coronavirus restrictions held firm. Many, like Idris, who depended on such meals, struggled to get through the fasting. Muslim clergy and head of the Nasfat Mosque, Sharafuddin Abdusalam, says they found other ways to hold prayers.
So most of our lectures last year were online lectures. And people don't come to the mosque last year to observe Taraweeh. People don't come for the 5-day prayer.
But things are different this year. Nigeria is seeing a lower number of cases, and mosques across the country are once again holding regular meetings and prayers. But the World Health Organization and Nigeria's CDC are also warning of a possible rise of COVID-19 cases during Ramadan. Mosque Secretary Abimbola Okwala says they're taking steps to prevent that.
As we are entering the mosque, there's provision for you to wash your hand. We have a tap, about 4 or 5 tap, at the gates. So as you are entering, the first place that you go to, there is an arrow, and there are some security personnel that will ensure that you wash your hand.
Okwala says everyone entering the mosque must also wear a face mask in line with WHO recommendations. Charity banquets and other communal gatherings remain banned in many countries around the world because of an upsurge in cases. But with safety measures in place, Ramadan this year is easier for Nigerian Muslims like Isa Idris. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Now to Zimbabwe, where analysts and teachers' union warn that boarding schools face a COVID-19 implosion. Eddie Gondo gives us more on the story.
According to the health ministry's situational report, 2 schools in Matabeleland South reported 106 cases of COVID-19, reigniting fears that schools were not ready to resume classes. Umzingwane High School and Sacred Heart Girls High School in Eskodini reported a combined 106 cases. Despite the ministry's assurances that the situation is under control, teachers' unions and others say that's not the case. Schools reopened on March 15th with students attending on alternate days as the government eased some COVID-19 restrictions. Mass temperature checks and washing of hands in all public areas remain in place. A national vaccination program is being rolled out. But teachers' unions have long raised questions on whether proper precautions were in place. Yesterday, a statement by the Progressive Teachers Union, PTUZ, blamed the Ministry of Primary and Secondary School for the new cases, saying COVID-19 abatement equipment in schools is in dire need. The union's president, Takawa Firajo, weighs in.
The $750 million that the government allocated to schools to buy COVID equipment seemed not to have filtered to the school. It seemed to have gone into private pocket. The classes in schools are still bloated, with some teachers teaching a class of about 103 students, 90 students, and this has ensured that there is no social distance. The Minister of Education has also not recruited more teachers in order to ensure a proper teacher ratio of 1:20 as encouraged by WHO. There is no running water in schools.
Before schools reopened, ministry officials claimed they had found a high level of preparedness, a point teachers' unions reject, saying, for example, teachers, ancillary staff and pupils were not tested. Obed Masaraure of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Unions of Zimbabwe, R2s, also said schools reopened too soon.
We warned the government of Zimbabwe against the reckless opening of schools, but they didn't take heed of our call. We are pushing for mandatory testing of all those who are going to participate in the physical school ecosystem. Unfortunately, our government chose to blindly accept both learners and teachers. It is a fact that our schools are now the super spreaders of COVID-19. It is a fact that if there's a third wave, it is being brewed in our schools.
Observers say urgent action is needed, saying it will be more costly to manage COVID-19 than to prevent the spread. Meanwhile, Masaraure confirmed that demand for vaccines is sluggish.
Very few teachers have been vaccinated. There's limited access to information on the vaccination program. And there's still a lot of skepticism on the vaccines themselves. So there was need for a lot of education so that at least we have more uptake of the vaccine by the teachers.
Observers say fractious relations between the government and its workers is in part to blame for the situation. They say dialogue would help mitigate the trust deficit. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Vanuatu, a remote chain of more than 80 islands in the Pacific, is one of the few countries in the world where the coronavirus has not spread. How did they do it? Ginny Stein has more for VOA from Vanuatu's capital city, Port Vila.
Vanuatu was very lucky in that we closed our borders right at the beginning.
Not one case of community transmission, although three people have tested positive while in quarantine.
The message this small country is trying to tell the world is, in all your considerations, please give some serious thought to the fact that we are COVID-free.
Armed with limited testing kits, Vanuatu took action to make use of what it had. It's been carrying out pool testing of new arrivals to conserve use of its resources.
We've got a very good monitoring system, quarantine monitoring system in Vanuatu that enables us to track it right up front.
This island paradise may be COVID-free, but it doesn't mean Vanuatu is not hurting. In the dominant tourism sector, 70% of tourism jobs have been lost.
The tourism economy is 60% overall, whether directly or indirectly. So, of course, the borders have gone completely shut. So we went from full lots of tourists to absolutely nothing within days.
Maxel Ansariel shut his tour company when borders closed. He is now helping another tourism operator to sell its assets.
We are trying to look for some solution out. The only possible solution we are looking forward for is the vaccine.
Getting hold of vaccines is the government's first challenge. Craig says distribution across a chain of more than 80 islands will be an extremely complex operation.
If we can get vaccinated and support from our more developed partners and the rollout and the doctors and the nurses to come and help with the logistics of it, then we can achieve that. Without that support, it's going to be very, very challenging for a third world medical system that's already has its own, you know, it's running at capacity now.
While life in Vanuatu continues to be COVID-free, lack of tourist jobs means that thousands are trying to travel to neighbouring Australia and New Zealand to work on farms, including 23-year-old Elisha Laloy.
I want to go to Australia because it's a really hard time now. With the COVID, everything in Vanuatu is closing down, so I have to go and work to earn some money to come and help my family.
To save its economy, Vanuatu needs its citizens to be vaccinated, and the same for arrivals. Not one dose has yet arrived, but the government continues to hope its program will start by June. Ginny Stein, Port Vila, Vanuatu, for Voice of America.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe and wash your hands more frequently and strive to make every day a healthy day. This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.